Welcome back to the new Talk the Bob Davis Podcasts. This is going to be a special couple of podcasts. Podcast 431 and 432 with Jason Lewis and Dave Thompson out here in Lakeville. We are awaiting everybody showing up here at the Mobile Podcast Command Unit, which is sitting out here on Main Street in Lakeville. And podcast 432 is being done on Halloween. And Halloween, as I've often said, is sort of the line of demarcation between fall and winter. The leaves have fallen and we're heading into winter, so it's a great time to have Ryan Plumbing and Heating come out and check your furnace, check your plumbing, check your water heater to make sure everything's working right. And when they come out, ask them about upgrading your heating system with Smart Tech, because with Smart Tech these days, even if you have just had your furnace and your heating system updated even just 5 or 6 years ago, you have the opportunity to save a lot of money over a few years with Smart Tech. I will tell you, it isn't cheap, but it certainly is worth it. Plus, it's a good idea to have the plumbing checked and the water heater checked, because you don't want to have these kinds of problems in winter. So here's what you do. Call Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. The number is 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Have them come out and check everything metro-wide from St. Paul. That means the suburbs too. For four generations, they do residential and business, and Ryan's number is great to keep handy for emergencies, because they do emergency service. Once again, in St. Paul and eastern suburbs, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis and the western suburbs, 612-927-6488. I guess north and south, you know, you can use either number. Obviously, these days, you can call 651 or you can call 612. It doesn't matter what part of the metro you're in, so either number works. And don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, where they've always been. So thanks, Greg Ryan, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Oh, well, you just do what I mean.
Well, let's open this sucker up and we can continue this conversation.
No, it's rolling.
Before these people need an ambulance.
It's rolling. So, okay, I'll open it up. So, and the good thing is,
you can do anything.
So, welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 431. And we're going to be joined by Senator Dave Thompson and, of course, Jason Lewis, who's a candidate for Congress in the 2nd District in Minnesota. Tim Pitcher is here. And everybody just say hello. There's
Hello.
Hello, everybody.
The ambulance is full of people.
And could we get names here? We got Tim. Let's go. Beth.
Beth. Colin Hoffer Raskovich.
Sheila.
Frank.
Teresa. Kathy.
Wonderful.
Bob.
I'm Wayne Newton. what?
So, okay, I think we should start with the debate last night on Almanac, and I can't believe I'm actually going to mention a public television outlet, but you don't have to comment on that. But so there's how many candidates in the second at this
right
point
now.
for the Republican
yes.
endorsement?
Yes.
And the big question is this endorsement question. Everybody wants to know, you know, whether or not these candidates are going to abide by the Republican endorsement process. Do you have any views on that at this point?
Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned public television, and when we were talking about making the tax code flatter and fairer and trying to get a situation where small business doesn't have to pay 39.6% because they flow through their 1040 and GE doesn't pay anything. So I'm saying we've got to eliminate the loopholes and the special interests. And I was going right down carried interest, export-import bank, TARP, the stimulus plan. And I was just going to get to tax-exempt nonprofits like public television.
Nice.
But I thought, well, I'll bite my tongue on that one. It is amazing. You've got these tax-exempt organizations, healthcare plans, the NCAA, paying their executives seven figures and then calling on corporations to pay higher taxes. And they don't pay anything.
Mm.
At the corporate level, because they're tax exempt. So that's a massive loophole. Tom Coburn, former senator from Oklahoma, has done a great job on that. As to the endorsement, that was interesting. I think it was the last question, and everybody thought I would hedge it and say, well, I don't know, and I've been advised not to abide, but you know what? We're going to win the endorsement. And if you can't win the endorsement, you got a bigger problem. So I came out last night and said, you bet I'll abide. Now, it is ironic that Pam Myra or David Gerson would lecture anybody on the endorsement, given that Pam helped create a quorum crisis at last year's state convention, then ran in the primary, didn't abide. David Gerson was district hopping in 2012, ran for the endorsement in the 5th district, lost it, So he jumps to the second and runs in the primary. I mean, talk about chutzpah. How do you run in two districts in the same cycle? So for them to lecture anybody about an endorsement is, you know, it's a bit like Elmer Gantry talking about fidelity. So I will abide, and I'm looking forward to talking with every delegate. And I got guys like Dave Thompson helping me, and can't lose.
We do have some potential delegates here, so that's pretty good. So let's talk about the second district. This is a district which people think of, you know, is conservative, and of course John Klein has gotten into, you know, the weeds a little bit with some of his votes, and people will say, well, the second district isn't quote unquote as conservative as people think it is. How would you describe what you are? Would you describe yourself as a quote unquote principled conservative, or how do you deal with a district that might not be as conservative as people think it
is? Well, you're right. It's a swing district now. John, and look, say what you want about John Klein. I didn't agree with all of his votes, but he offered some distinguished service to this country, and long before Congress, as we all
right.
know. So he and I are going to disagree on things, but I'm not going to sit here and be the anti-Klein or beat up on John Klein. He's a
well,
fine
no, it's
man.
Not about Klein. It's about the district.
And the district, Obama wins by what, 360 votes last vote? Franken wins it? This is a swing district now. So you have to have positions that appeal across the lines, that transcend party lines. And what wonderful development that has occurred in the last few months and years in politics is this notion that there are no longer any straight talking points. The idea that I would be sitting here in 2015 beating up on GE for not paying taxes. Oh, 20 years ago in the Republican Party, banish the thought. We're the party of big corporations. You can't do that. Or that Dave Thompson would be railing correctly against stadium subsidies, of which, by the way, one of my opponents supported in the legislature, John Howe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he voted for the final Vikings bill. So that idea would be foreign to Republican politics 10, 15 years ago. That's precisely the way you reach across, get the blue-collar Reagan Democrats. You say, look, we got to eliminate corporate welfare along with social welfare abuse. We just can't be the party, the big government conservative that says, well, we got to cut the Democratic programs, but our programs are okay. And there was no better example of that this week the budget sequester deal that was undone in another backroom deal when big government Republicans like Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Peter King...
$50 billion in new spending this
$80
year,
billion over 2 years.
And then $30 billion in 2017.
Got in bed in a backroom deal and let the American people see exactly what's wrong.
So when you get to Congress, my understanding is that the pressure on these congressmen is extreme, that there's so much pressure, and that's one of the problems and why these certain congressmen that supposedly are principled end up...
Who do you mean there, Dave?
I mean, there's a lot of pressure. You're one of 435 people whose vote is going to have a huge impact on business and quote-unquote moneyed interests and things like that. I hate to keep saying quote-unquote, I'm sorry. But you know what I mean.
Look at a guy like my old buddy here, Dave Thompson. He wasn't going to stay in the legislature, and I don't know what his future plans are for certain, forever. He wanted to actually do something. He didn't want to just assume the state Senate seat down here. He wanted to do something. And that is 90% of the battle. A lot of people go there and say, this is going to be a great job. I'm going to be an important person. They're going to put a microphone in front of me. I've had my 15 minutes. I don't need that. And I'm certainly not going to stay there longer than 3 or 4 terms. I'm 60 years old. Oh, everybody's shocked in here, I know. No? Yeah. Tim's going, I thought you were 65.
Right?
All right. So I'm going to go there and get something done. And I don't need a career. I don't need the job. I think that's half the battle.
And let me say something. Having lived in the Senate now for a while, I know what it's like and what it takes to stand up against leadership. And frankly, one of the reasons I'm very excited about Jason is I've known him personally for many years and listened to him for many years on the radio before that. Number one, he understands what he believes and he's consistent about it. And frankly, some of the things that he mentioned where conservatives are now very different than they used to be, he was ahead of the curve on those things.
That's right.
And he was talking about those things long before run-of-the-mill Republicans would. Secondly, he doesn't need the money, he doesn't need the job, he doesn't need the title. As he said, he's been in front of a microphone enough, he doesn't need that. And I believe he's the exact kind of guy that will go to Washington and do what he says, because I've observed him over the decades, really, and he has stuck to the things he believes in, and he knows what he believes, and I have no doubt in my mind that he will follow through with the things that he tells people on the campaign trail, and to me that's critically important.
You know, it's a great thing about everybody in this room, that when you know what you believe and you have the courage of your convictions, you don't need to argue with yourself over which position should I take. That was a great thing about Reagan, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
He knew what he believed. He actually believed this stuff. That was scary to the left. And so you don't say, oh, the poll says this, but there's no debate in my mind. I know what I believe.
Okay,
and that's actually liberating.
What kind of a shape does a Jason Lewis congressional, what are you going to do if you get there?
Well, one of the first things I want to do is get a handle on federal spending. I'm not going to be a congressman that tells these good folks here, I'm going to bring home the pork. What do you need? I'll bring it home. That's exactly why we've got a debt crisis, a debt bomb. And people don't realize how bad the 18 to 20 now, to 20 trillion, thanks to this budget sequester deal, or lack of, it is. Right now, interest on the debt is $200 billion a year. Well, no problem. We're rolling over the debt at low interest rates, right? The CBO, which is no friend to us, has predicted that by 2025, in a decade, interest on the debt will be $800 billion a year. It'll be larger than defense spending, larger than non-defense discretionary spending. We've got a debt bomb, and that's from spending. A lot of people talk about a balanced budget amendment, which I'm not necessarily opposed, but the Democrats actually like that in some ways because they can say, oh gosh, we've got a record amount of revenues in fiscal 2015, $3.2 trillion, but we still have a deficit of $400 billion.
How is that possible?
To be fiscally responsible, we got to raise taxes because we got a balanced budget. That's what the media's idea of fiscal responsibility is. We got keep spending and have somebody else do the tax collection. I would prefer a federal spending limitation amendment because it doesn't matter how you finance the spending, whether you tax, whether you inflate, whether you borrow, it all comes out of your pocket.
That's right.
So that's my first task.
So one of the favorite pork projects, and I would have to call it pork.
Did I mention JasonLewis2016.com?
That's a Hillary Clinton joke, I think, isn't it? Didn't she do that in 2012? What? That was her whole thing, HillaryClinton.com. And she would stop in the middle of, better watch out. No, I'm just kidding.
It is Halloween.
So Klein's big thing was education. That's right, it is Halloween. Klein's big thing was education, which to me is a sinkhole of spending. But there's, when you talk about these districts where people are so-called moderates, they're really, it's very hard to attack spending on education.
It is sad that in this day and age, when you're running for a federal office, you actually get into a subject that ought to be a local concern that Dave Thompson ought to be handling, not Jason Lewis in Washington, D.C. And that is really a sort of a sign of the times. We've got a federal Department of Education now totaling $100 billion. Remember, there was always an Office of Education. It was in Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, the old cabinet sector. Jimmy Carter, in a payback to the unions it was 78 or 79, created a cabinet-level Department of Education. Ever since then, we've had this micromanaging from, you know, it used to be these multicultural programs forced down. Then it was school-to-work schemes and No Child Left Behind, and now it's Common Core, which the even though the state so-called created it, the Fed gives incentive money for states to implement this sort of a cookie-cutter bureaucratic groupthink nonsense. So we've got to either reform the Department of Education or send it back to an office inside another cabinet-level agency and return education to the Dave Thompsons of the world and let him grapple with the issues. But in all seriousness, that's the beauty of federalism, and that's what I believe in.
Well, let me tell you that having been in a position to work on state budgets, so much of what we do is dictated by the feds, and the reason they can dictate to us, even though it is not constitutionally permitted, is we take the money. They're our dealer. They are our dealer.
Title I money.
Yes.
That's right.
And they give us just enough money in education, predominantly focused on special ed. They do the same thing in health and human services, to the point that states no longer have control over their own budgets. And that sounds like an excuse, but to a large extent,
it's true. It's true, but here we are.
It tramples the 10th Amendment.
If I'm a Democrat candidate, I'm going to say, obviously, Jason Lewis is against education.
No, I'm
because he wants to cut education, and your schools are going to have to close their doors, and we're going to have to send special ed students home, and all this terrible stuff is going to happen.
Has the $100 billion a year we spend in the federal government on the Department of Education helped your local school district? Has it helped it one iota? Does anybody believe that? I mean, this is the problem we've got with education. Do Common Core standards help? Even the teachers are opposed to Common Core standards, for crying out loud. And their union is not exactly a friend of ours.
Right.
But let me tell you the real watershed that's going to happen this Supreme Court term. Remember Harris v. Quinn when Governor Quinn...
I don't remember that one.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's not on everybody's mind. When Governor Quinn, as well as Governor Dayton, were trying to unionize the last bastion of free market daycare and pre-K through 12 schooling.
Illinois Governor Quinn.
Illinois Governor. And they wanted to unionize them by saying, well, you get Medicaid money, you get public assistance money, therefore you must be employees of the government, therefore you can union. They were businesses. I don't know how you unionize a business. Yeah, that's called a cartel. So they tried to do that. Supreme Court intervenes in the Illinois case and said, there's a little thing called freedom of association in the First Amendment. And if these businesses don't want to join, be forced to join a union, they shouldn't have to. End of Dayton's scheme, end of Quinn's scheme. Now, guess what the follow-up that is? This term, the Supreme Court is deciding whether public employees, including teachers, have to pay fair share agreements, a closed shop, collective bargaining, when they become a public employee. And if the same vote holds, 5-4, it's going to be close. All of a sudden, in Minnesota, they say, well, you don't have to join Education Minnesota if you want to be a teacher. But if you don't, you still have to pay 85% of the dues. It's called fair share. If the court rules, as I think they might, and strikes that down, you're going to see what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin writ large. You're going to have even the most diehard union members say, you know, I think I'll take the $200 a month and put it in my own pocket. And all of a sudden, do public employees have the rights of freedom of association? And I think they do. And that's going to be a real shot across the bow when it comes to education.
So let's talk about another second district issue, which is, and really it's a state of Minnesota issue in addition to a spending issue, and that's transportation, light rail, and, you know, oddly, the geographic shape of the second district. I don't know how much transportation,
zip rail,
you know, whatever the heck it is, but this is a big issue here, you know, in the metro and the fifth district and the second as well. And
did I mention JasonLewis2016.com? Oh, I'm sorry.
So for some of us, and I'll just identify, I mean, this is really, you know, it's a biased question, but I think that we need to kill federal funding for light rail projects completely.
You're going to walk away from free money, Bob?
Yeah, there you go.
Come on.
This goes exactly to what Dave was talking about a moment. We would have none of these projects without the capital seed money from the Highway Trust Fund at the federal level. So we're paying our 18.4 cents a gallon taxes to the feds. They take that money. Since 1982, when the mass transit account kicked in, and about 20% of every dollar you pay in federal taxes goes to the mass transit account now. It goes to that, so then they take your federal gas tax dollars and send it off to San Diego to build a light rail line. That is the genesis of the problem. And by the way, the Highway Trust Fund is broke. General revenues are now bailing it out. So the answer there clearly is to say, if we're going to spend gas taxes or pay gas taxes to the feds, it ought to be spent on road uses. Or, here's a real radical notion, and there's a bill in the House to do this, the interstate system is built. The interstate system is done. Eisenhower's dream is done. Why do we send 19 cents a gallon to Washington on the pretext that they'll give it back to us?
Aren't they supposed to be fixing, like, it's built, but it's old now, so we have to repair the infrastructure?
Well, we've had an infrastructure crisis since Bill Clinton ran for office. And every time we have an election cycle, there's an infrastructure crisis. So we pay more, and the next cycle, guess what? There's still an infrastructure crisis. It never ends. The fundamental problem is we can spend our own gas tax dollars on what we need here. Believe it or not, states are competent enough to make certain the interstates meet at one end of the border so they meet together at both ends. They can do that. So that's a radical solution. I mean, there are people that believe that we should just do away with the Highway Trust Fund and let states keep their 18.4 cents and build what they need. If you did that, all I'm saying is you wouldn't have all these projects because the states can't afford them without the federal seed money.
As long as the money in the state is said to be used only for highways.
That's Dave's problem.
And the problem is that they end up using the money for all sorts of things.
That is the purpose of these laboratories of democracy, known as the states. There are going to be states that screw up. California comes to mind, Massachusetts, and there are going to be states that do well. But, you know, the whole purpose of why I'm running is to limit what the federal government should be doing. It is a federal government, not a national government. And so, yes, you defer these things to the states, and that's where I want the tough decisions to be made on local concerns that affect citizens of a state at local government levels.
How far do you go in limiting the federal government?
Well, it's called the Constitution. I mean, that's and they've got it's a pretty good blueprint.
If it ain't in Article 1, Section 8, the federal government shouldn't do it.
Well, yeah, but that's open to interpretation, as I'm sure the opponents will point
out. No, it's not open to interpretation.
Out.
It's open to obfuscation. when the left says, well, the general welfare clause allows the federal government
to do the general welfare
anything
welfare
it wants. The tax and spending clause.
And so far it has, and they've been able to get away with it.
And has Jefferson said during the debates.
And how dare you go to Washington and rain on that parade, that general welfare parade.
Well, if all we need is a general welfare clause, we can do away with Article 1, Section 8.
There you go.
Why enumerate the powers that Congress may uphold or implement if the general welfare clause covers everything?
And do they use it then to get all this
the
stuff?
The general welfare clause is a proclamation of thought, of intent. Whenever you're looking at an agreement or a contract, specific terms always dominate generalities. And it is very clear when you look at Article 1, Section 8, when you look at the amendments to the Constitution, that in no way did the drafters of the Constitution have in mind that general welfare would mean the federal government could do anything. They said, that's right, they said the federal government can do these things, and if they don't, and if they are not specifically told they can do these things, then pursuant to the 9th and 10th Amendments, everything else is left to the states.
What about the canal?
And that's a fundamental key, what they've just said. We have all the rights.
What about
The state and the people have all the rights. They're called God-given rights. We have them. What we give to the government is a few limited things they may do. And there was a great debate at the time of the founding over the Bill of Rights. The Federalists were opposed to the Bill of Rights. Hamilton, Madison, and Jay said, wait a minute, if you start listing the rights, what people may do or what rights they have, they'll think those are the only rights. So they insisted on the 9th and 10th Amendments. We have all the rights. The states have all the prerogatives. Here's what the federal government may do. Oh, it's listed right there. And if it's not there, they can't do it.
Well, how have they gotten away with this all these years, then?
Well, the courts. I mean, you go back to the beginning of the 20th century. You can go back to Lochner. You can go to Gitlow. You can go to West Coast Hotel. And then, of course, the activism of the 60s. And the courts have said, oh, well, you know, we actually believe that this is a good idea. And good ideas mean we've got to trump the Constitution. And they did. And that was called the Revolution of 37 during the Roosevelt. People forget what the New Deal was all about. The New Deal was all about writing a new Constitution without actually writing it.
And why Roosevelt packed the court.
Exactly. Or threatened to pack it. Right.
Yeah, sometimes I kind of wonder whether the era that we're living in now resembles that era in the way it must have felt to people in the 30s, although I don't think the economic contraction was as severe as the 30s were. But it feels like we're rewriting the Constitution now, even with the Republicans in the majority in the House.
I think there have been three
phases.
The New Deal was clearly the National Industrial Recovery Act is just like the stimulus package. It failed to work after 5 years in 1938. The unemployment rate was still 20%. Very similar on the economic front. But that was a court or a judicial revolution. Then there was LBJ. And that was a massive revolution in the growth of government. And now we've got the Obama era. But they're all built upon the idea that courts will actually legislate and they will do what's good, not what the law says.
Okay. So do you have any, I suppose, another favorite second district issue? Because there's a lot of suburbs out here. And really, again, weirdly
shaped. A lot of agricultural
land,
too.
I keep saying out here, but it's a district that runs pretty far. It runs to Woodbury, so it's a second district is odd. They're all oddly
and down
shaped.
To Red Wing and over. It's an interesting district, isn't it? I mean, it's rural, it's suburban, and it's out south St. Paul. It's urban to a degree, so it really is an interesting district.
Agenda 21 and suburban development and roundabouts and things of that nature that people seem to be upset about out here. We've talked about education. Let's talk about development a little bit. And I know some of that is local, but there's a lot of federal dollars involved in city government. You talk about found money or what do they call it? Free money. You're going to walk away from free money from the federal government. How do you deal with that?
Well, and Dave could chime in on this, too. No one knows more about the smart growth agenda than what we've done in Minnesota with the University of Minnesota's Institute on Race and Poverty and Myron Orfield, smart growth, the new urbanist agenda. It's a lot more than roundabouts. I mean, it is talking about now forced housing. Thanks to HUD, there is a plan to have an ethnic spreadsheet of every neighborhood in the entire metro area and across the country for ethnic diversity, for diversity quotas. So if you think forced busing was bad, wait till you see forced housing. And I think it's called Affirmatively Affirming Sustainable Development. There's some acronym out there. And so they've got that going at HUD, and thanks to those grants. And then, of course, here in Minnesota, you've got this agenda, and it's all about regional government. That's really what it's about. It's about growing the purview of an unelected body called the Met Council, so through MUSA lines, through all sorts of things, they can control. And why? This is why I'm such a big fan of federalism and local government. If government gets out of control, you can leave. You can vote with your feet. But if the power of government expands and it becomes regional, where do you go? And if it comes, it really expands to the federal level, the national level, it's hard to leave the country. And Lord, if the UN and Agenda 21 gets control, how do you escape Earth? Unless, of course, you're Shirley MacLaine. So
who?
This is the purpose of small, divided jurisdictions.
Yes.
You know, I ought to write a book about that.
Yeah. It would be called Power Divided and Power Checked.
And Jason used the term earlier, laboratories of democracy. And see, leftists require uniformity to maintain their power, because leftism fails every time it's tried. And so if we try it to a large degree here in Minnesota, then North Dakota is going to grow and they're going to benefit from it. And so is Wisconsin. And so
you mean refugees will go?
Refugees,
socialist,
exactly.
Refugees.
That's right.
They really don't want to decry the system, but they'll move to North Dakota because the
that's right. Texas,
and then they'll ruin it.
And what you see out of St. Paul and the Met Council is saying, wait a minute, people want to move to Lakeville to avoid this urbanist kind of mess that they got. Well, we got to bring the urbanist mess to them.
Right. And they can't allow people to escape.
That's right. And the same thing is done at the federal level. Oh, you mean people actually want to live in Wyoming where there's freedom and liberty? Well, we got to end that, right?
In this metro,
they want everybody in a high-density Soviet-style apartment next to a light rail line. That's the goal, because we just don't have enough space.
It used to be in this metro.
And that's what they're building.
You had to move to, now there's, 12 metro counties. So you really have to move to way out there.
Why do you see Lakeville exploding? Why do you see all these suburban areas going great guns? People want to get out.
Yeah.
You know, they can talk about the wonderful... And building stadiums and soccer fields is not going to change the equation.
Isn't that a baseball stadium that's now going to be a soccer field, too? Another one that's ridiculous to me. But fortunately, we didn't have to build another stadium. But I figured that... How much was that stadium?
Well,
it's still
the soccer plan is still tax-exempt off the
roll, is it?
So, yeah.
Right.
I interviewed Michelle Bachmann the other day, and she went on for, you know, Michelle is a fire hose.
Yep.
You ask her a question and she'll talk for an hour. And I literally had to...
I can't stand people like that. I'm telling you.
I literally had to interrupt her, but she went off and she started with immigration.
Yep.
So this is an important issue, obviously, nationwide. And to a degree, it's important here because we're not just taking people from, quote-unquote, illegal immigrants from places like Central America and Mexico, but we have people coming here due to the aegises of the Lutheran Brotherhood who are coming from Western and Eastern Africa. And it seems to be quite a lot of them. And then there's this whole question of the Syrian refugees as well. You know, she was really worked up on this immigration issue.
Well, I've been described as a small L libertarian myself. I've described myself, and as Reagan said in a famous Reason magazine interview in 1975, libertarianism, small L, is the conscience of conservatism, and I believe that. But even the late great Milton Friedman, who believed in the free mobility of capital and labor across national boundaries. I mean, if you're free, you ought to be able to buy what you want from another country. You ought to be able to travel. You ought to be able to do what? Even he, and is really instigated by his wife Rose, before he died, said, true, ideally that's the case, but you cannot have open borders with a modern welfare state. And that's what we've got. We've got this magnet, the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, Emergency Medical Treatment Act of 85, the Plyler v. Doe decision in 1982, which says illegal immigrants have to get free education. So right now, illegal immigration is costing us $115 billion a year, about $85 billion to the states who have to pay education, corrections, medical. It's unsustainable. It's absolutely unsustainable. Think of our immigration policy. High-skilled immigrants come here on a temporary work visa. They get their education, they're computer programmers, and as soon as that's up, back home you go. We kick them out. But then we end up, because we don't control the borders, subsidizing low-skilled immigration here. It is totally backwards.
So that's
one of the reasons I'm not afraid of Trump.
So no. President Trump will build a wall, and you would vote to
sure.
do
you can, we, the idea you can't build a wall? I mean, of course you could. It's just a matter of will, though, whether that takes a wall or whether that takes getting serious about it. That's all. And you mentioned one thing else before Dave comes in, and that's the idea of legal immigration that nobody talks about. So that's illegal immigration. The idea of legal immigration, thanks to the Vologs, and you're talking about, and I know this is stepping on toes, but you mentioned the Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities. These outfits wear their compassion on their sleeve, but then they go to the State Department, get a grant to relocate tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of refugees, all legal, into the Twin Cities
and soon
Syrian refugees, 200,000, right. If John Kerry gets his way, embedded with ISIS terrorists. This is absolute insanity. You get a terrorist recruitment problem. So I think that's...
We already have a terrorist recruitment
exactly.
problem.
Exactly. And so now we're going to take 200,000 more Syrian right. refugees. Well, don't worry, they're the good guys. We have no idea. The former Joint Chief said, Martin Dempsey said, we really don't know who these Syrian rebel groups are. But we'll take them in. Shrewd move.
What's wrong with these guys? I'm serious.
They're internationalists. They don't recognize not only a physical border, they don't recognize legal borders. They're international. That's what liberals do. They intervene at home in the economy, so naturally they'd want to intervene abroad.
Free trade.
Well, I want to get Dave's take on that.
Actually, I'm not going to give you a take on that. I got to give you a Michelle Bachmann story. True story involving you. And I've never told you this.
I gotta go, folks.
No, you're good. You're good. I'm not gonna do anything to damage your chances here. So one day, I get called by KSTP to sit in for Jason, back when he was on 5 to 8 on AM 1500. And I had that feeling at about 2:30 in the afternoon, like, I don't feel very good. But I'm not gonna call him and say, you gotta put on a best of for the Jason Lewis show on a weekday. So I start heading into the studio, and I'm feeling flush and sick, and I'm going, this isn't good. And I don't remember if Michelle had even been elected to the state senate yet, but I pick up the phone, I called Michelle, and I said, Michelle, I got to do this show, and I don't feel well. Would you come in at 7 and be my guest?
You're not going to have to do anything.
So by the time I get to the studio, Jason, I am so sick that I am talking, shutting the mic off, putting my head down on the console, and the producer is literally having to almost wake me up. So Michelle comes in at 7 o'clock, and I said, Michelle, I'm so sick, I can't see straight. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to put my head down on the console. Talk as long as you can.
Well, that was
7:59.
At 7:59, I walked out and left, and I got home.
Four hours later, she was still on the air.
And I had a temperature of 101.5.
Wow.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, that was a mess. But it was.
She's been a trooper.
Great Michelle story.
Yeah,
well,
right.
And true.
So you're not going to... The immigration thing, I don't know what the state application of that, because a lot of this is federal law, and then we get into county sheriffs and
It has a state application, particularly in Minnesota, where, as you know, we take a disproportionately high percentage of immigrants. And as Jason pointed out, when you have essentially open borders and don't require legality in our immigration and give people refugee status, and we have a welfare state, it puts such pressure on our social services systems that it is another straw that's breaking the camel's back.
You can leave that door open if those people want to see what's going on in here. Actually, why don't you swing that door open? Just unhook it and swing it open.
I've lost 4 pounds already in here.
That way people can see what's going on. We can hear the diesel.
And if anybody's sick walking by, they go, oh, ambulance, just in time.
Yeah.
Thanks to Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. You can call them now and schedule just a heating check, a water heater check, as well as a plumbing check. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Ask them about Smart Check for your heating systems. They can save you money over a couple of years. Metro-wide from St. Paul, and that means the suburbs too. Ryan Plumbing and Heating, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. They do residential and business. And by the way, ryanplumbing.com, brand new website with a whole bunch of content. You might want to check it out. ryanplumbing.com tells you more about the company. And thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcasts. Well, thank you for listening to the Bob Davis podcast with Jason Lewis and Dave Thompson out in Lakeville. Don't forget the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast, Alpha Systems. We know that there are pilots listening. In fact, there's a pilot right here, Bob from the Marine Corps, USMC retired, a helicopter pilot. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA has saved lives. It's FAA approved, and we want it to be part of your avionics package. Click click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. That pretty much does it for this podcast, Podcast 431, live from Lakeville. Stay tuned for Part 2, which will be Podcast 432. Thank you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. And thanks for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter, you guys. And thanks for the donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. They go to funding the Mobile Podcast Command Unit, which I am broadcasting live from as we speak. And again, thanks for listening to Podcast 431. Jason and Dave and everybody, thank you so much.